Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 541. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast, the most proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on this wonderful network, go and visit evergreenpodcasts.com. So this week's interview is with Ashley Dudaranok. Ashley's been on my show before. She's a Chinese serial entrepreneur, award-winning digital marketing professional, and multiple-time author. Recognized as a guru on digital marketing and fast-evolving trends in China by Thinkers50, Ashley is the founder of the China-focused digital marketing agency, Alaris, and China digital consultancy, Chozan. She's also the author of 10 books about digital China, including her latest, Innovation Factory, China's Digital Playbook for Global Brands, which was co-written with Ron Wardle. In this conversation with Ashley, we discuss the Chinese digital landscape. What are some of the salient trends? What can Western brands learn from Chinese corporations? The place for purpose in China. The sense of trust that Chinese citizens have with Chinese companies. The leadership challenges and management styles. And a whole lot more. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. And if you have a wee moment, go over and drop in a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Righty-ho, Ashley Dudaranok. Lovely to have you on my show. You are a beacon of energy, an expert on China, and whoa, so productive on books. In your own words, who is Ashley?
Ashley is a Chinese serial entrepreneur. That's who she is. And working with digital and reinventing the future of retail. I think that would be the best way to describe it. And I'm so happy to be here on your show. Thank you so much, Minter, for bringing me on.
Well, you certainly are a charismatic individual and you lead by example. Your LinkedIn is a treasure trove for anyone interested in working on China or doing anything in China. So tell us, what is your business actually?
I've got three main businesses, all related to China. My teams are in Hong Kong, in Shanghai, in Shenzhen. And basically the first business is more on the training and consulting side, where we train global companies how to be more successful in China with the relation to their marketing, commerce, and also bridging their global team and local China teams together. So it could be anything from operating a particular platform like Tmall, how to operate Tmall better, how to understand a consumer better, how to map a customer journey. And apart from training, we also do quite a lot of consulting in that space. The second business is from the digital marketing side. That's where we come in and we ultimately audit the brands. How is our brand doing in the China market? Where is the benchmark? What does good look like? And how do we get there? So in other words, we help brands, big brands yearly, to reinvent their China digital strategy. And then the third component to all that, we also do a lot of learn from China episodes where global tech giants look at China's digitalization and they say, wow, this is typically incredible. There were some mistakes, but there were a lot of successes. How do I take those lessons and implement them in the home market and hopefully shorten my learning curve? So if it's a a platform that looks into social commerce or live streaming or community retail or, you know, on demand, let's say entertainment, they come and they learn from China. So we deliver that in a form of keynote presentations or, you know, training courses, consulting projects, etc. So that's why it's mostly digital and mostly learn from China or learn for China.
I feel like there's a new acronym, WFC. You know, or LFC coming. So you have written many books. I don't know how many books you're up to, but I do want to get to talk about the book that I think is your last, Innovation Factory, China's Digital Playbook for Global Brands, that you co-wrote with Ron Wardle. But how many books have you actually written, Ashley? You have you're a stunning productive.
11 today. 11.
Congratulations. And, you know, in between the time that it took us to get this interview up and running, you also just published Metaverses for Business. So,
but I must say, it's very flattering. Thank you so much. But I must say, these are called mini books. And for those that are watching us, you know, as of through a video medium channel, they will see that these are tiny little books, and they're 140 or 50 pages. So what I call 1 hour book, right? You get on the flight and you basically are through with this book before the meal comes. So that's the outcome, that you get the condensed knowledge and it's easy and simple to understand because you can go as deep or as light on China as you want, right? So what we are ultimately trying to do is I've got 3 bigger books. They're much bigger. They are deeper on, you know, the topic of Chinese consumer. Then there's one deeper on the topic of China's new retail. And there's one deep book about the bloggers, how do influencers and all these MCNs, multi-channel networks, operate in China. So these are bigger books. But everything else are small mini books, introduction into the topic, be it a PR crisis or metaverses, because everybody was talking about this extended reality and metaverse. So we were looking into, okay, so how do we actually use them for businesses? What's happening in China? What's happening in the rest of the world? And right now, Innovation Factory, it's also a small book that is tapping into the topic of what can we learn from the China digital transformation recently in 3 areas, right? Which is the community, ultimately retail and social commerce. It is the leadership models. And of course, it is building of tech ecosystems. So these are the 3 major topics covered in that last one.
Indeed. So last time you were on my show was 2019. And we were talking about new retail, and it's fascinating. And I do want to get into this idea of what can Western companies possibly extract from the way Chinese companies operate in the good way, maybe a little less, but we'll talk maybe according to time on how to approach China if you're wanting to do that. But let's just sort of lay the scene in terms of where is China today? In terms of the big the penetration of internet online, the penetration of smartphones, because we get a lot of, I would say, conflicting information in terms of the way the foreign press will portray China, depending on their angle and their worry beads. But give us a lay of the land in terms of the tech, and then what are how are we doing with all the big companies Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, and all that, versus any Western companies? Are any Western companies actually penetrating into China in any significant way?
A very broad question, but I'll try to answer with a couple of numbers and facts. So when it comes to China, China has the highest penetration rate of smartphones in the world, and the penetration rate is 82.8%, nearly 83%. So that's around 1 billion people. When it comes to the internet, obviously, nearly everyone has an internet unless they are below 6 years old and they just do not own a phone. A good friend of mine's grandmother is 93 years old. She owns a smartphone. She orders her own Didi as of her own Uber, right, to pick her up, and she orders her own groceries online. So when it comes to, you know, China as a digital environment, it is very unique because First of all, China up until recently was a rather young country where people have undergone through multiple rounds of transformation and reinventing themselves. So if you look at Lived Changed Index, which is the index that tracks the way your life has improved on your parents' life. So if my grandmother went to the bathroom, you know, outside of the house, then my mother had a, you know, toilet kind of in suite, and I have a jacuzzi at home. So things like that. China is 30 times. That index is 30 times number one in the world. The second closest country is basically 8 times. And the US is very, very low on the list. It's only 2 or 3 times, basically, in the last 30 years. So China has gone through a lot of change over a very short period of time. So people were, back then, when the digitalization was just initiated, let's say 30, 20 years ago, very young, interested, excited. They were given a try to that technology. They did not have those legacy systems like credit cards, right? They did not have to go through a PC computer in order to get to mobile, etc. So that is why the transformation was happening really, really fast. And that has also birthed very demanding consumer, very excited consumer, the consumer that is digitally connected. And of course, we have companies that are serving those consumers that have both shaped them and are right now serving them. So these companies evolved into really strong ecosystems. And that's what we do not really have in the West that much. While many firms, big companies, are right now basically acquiring each other and trying to tap into similar services, and they are trying to build super apps, for instance, and, you know, expand into broader spheres of influence. In China, the transformation was very organic. So take Tencent as an example. They started from, games, and then doing social networking, and then opening a super app, WeChat, which was a horrible copy of WhatsApp back in the day, but evolved very, very quickly into a super app that right now, famously, Elon Musk says that this is the most comprehensive app in the world, and everybody should, you know, kind of copy and move towards that thing. So then they integrated payments, they integrated peer-to-peer transfers, ultimately acting as a bank, later on opening up their IP and API for mini programs, so encouraging developers to develop apps within the app, etc., right? So China went into ecosystems where a company is trying to dominate the portion of life of a customer and provides a variety of services. And then China obviously went into super apps, and beyond WeChat, we have, Alipay, we have Meituan Dianping, we have, you know, Didi, even Gaode Ditu, right? Gaode, it's basically a map app, also has their own kind of super app features. ByteDance's programs and mini programs and apps also have those features. So this is where China is today. It is definitely a unique Galapagos, like a digital Galapagos, because we have unique animals, we have unique landscape, and it is very isolated, because your question was also, so what's happening with the Western companies in China? Back in the day, when I was still living in Chongqing, I went to school in Chongqing studying business and economics. The Facebook was still in China. Google was in China. All these companies were operating and competing together with their, you know, Chinese counterparts. Later on, the regulations were introduced that if you would like to operate a digital business in China, you need to store data about the users on mainland Chinese servers. And that is when Google and, you know, right now Meta, but then Facebook and others decided to ultimately move their businesses out. There were a couple of platforms, for example, LinkedIn, probably one of the best known ones, that actually continued the battle up until very, very end. But then last year, they also, or earlier this year, I think it was, they also decided to exit social networking side of business. LinkedIn is still in China as a recruitment platform, but they are no longer operating as a networking app, because they were basically saying that it is not sustainable to maintain servers just for China. It's basically a business decision. So at least this is the official reason. And of course, my personal interpretation of all that is, in the past, let's say 5-10 years, the speed of innovation and the demands of that market are just way too much for, you know, for whatever we have in the West. So even if today's version of X, IG, Facebook or YouTube were accessible in China, they would very likely be a lot less successful than the local counterparts.
Yeah, because the market has moved on so much. In talking about the Chinese situation, I was also interested, I can't remember, I didn't check my facts, but it seemed that there is some limitation of usage for the young people who are in the effort of keeping education stronger. Where is that about, and how controlled is that actually?
Right. So that's all about the games. If you are gaming and you are below 18 years old, then there is a government requirement that you only game a certain number of hours a week, and you are not allowed to game during like work week, only on weekends or public holidays. And that is actually done in order to, official reason is, yes, in order to prevent children from being addicted. China is a huge gaming market, number one in the world, and Chinese companies actually are publishing a lot of games and developing a lot of games. There's a lot of fans in China that basically cannot get their hands off of those streams. I'm just looking at some data. And the number of approved games by China's regulators this year was already more than 500. And last year, they approved only 666 games. So what does it mean? It was not just about restricting the user access, as of young user access to the games, but Chinese regulators also looked at what kind of games are being published and introduced into the market. As we all have heard, in the past 3-4 years, China has been going through a very big wave of regulation. They were regulating tech, and that's also a very different approach compared to the West. In the West, we typically, a technology is barely birthed, and we stand around it, and we talk about how do we regulate it so it doesn't get out of control. In China, typically, if a technology is burst, be it blockchain, be it gaming, be it whatever, we let it flourish. Let's see where it takes us. And once it becomes big and important, and it's, you know, we already understand what's its direction or some of the dangers or some of the potential applications, that's when the regulators come in and start introducing rules that they think make sense. So that is why, yeah, this time it was basically very few games were allowed to be published. Plus young user controls were introduced, but already starting from this year, it looks a lot better compared to before.
Well, if we just stick with this notion for the youth, I have to imagine that some of these youngsters are quite savvy and know what a very private network is and figure out ways around it. But is that something that is unadvisable for them? And will there be crackdowns on that kind of a thing, or is it sort of somewhat loose?
I do not know what you mean by the private network, but ultimately
VPN,
right? So VPNs in China are officially banned, but of course everybody's using it, so half of the people that I know in mainland China are on Instagram. Instagram is not officially. Again, in the market, right? So people access videos from YouTube. People listen to the songs that we listen, you know, offline. People watch the movies that are not being released in cinemas. A friend of mine is working for a Chinese company called iQIYI. And iQIYI is like a Chinese sort of kind of YouTube plus Netflix. And they produce a lot of movies and, you know, shows and all that, not only for China, but also they have presence in the Southeast Asian market. So a lot of their in-demand content is actually BL. BL is boys love. So it is very often a homosexual story that is both appealing to heterosexual women and, let's say, homosexual communities. So what do you think? Who do you think accesses that content? Not only, you know, the Thai audience right outside of China, but also the mainland Chinese through VPNs get access to it. So it is very, very interesting. Chinese digital, or let's call them netizens, they are very digitally savvy. They do have accesses to paid VPNs and services. But of course, when we talk about them, it is typically wealthier Gen Zs. These are typically more educated Gen Zs. These are typically people that traveled abroad, that have interest in what's happening, you know, in the rest of the world, et cetera. They have, you know, hobbies and, you know, connections all around the world. There is also a very big majority in China that is very, very local. And we shall not forget that talking about China, anything you say is a generalization. It is such a big country. You think about China as Europe. You know, people in Germany are not the same as people in the south of France or in Finland or in, let's say, anywhere else, right? So Chinese in the north, south, center are very different. Plus, where do you come from? What's your educational background, etc.? It's a huge country, 1.4 billion people. So, of course, there are a lot of young, also Gen Zs, that live in smaller towns. They are gaming. They are very much, proud of the country, of the rise of Chinese brands. They are voting local, and they have their own completely different pace. And maybe these are the people that, unless they have a very strong reason, like they need to access the game that cannot be accessed, you know, in China, they would really not have any interest in getting the VPN and accessing anything outside of the country. But the ones that have such a need or desire definitely can get it quite easily. I think this will continue. And actually, interestingly, right now we have a former politician. I forgot which one, so I don't want to lie to you, but one very prominent former politician who is calling in China to introduce free internet in certain zones to encourage international companies, basically, you know, setting up offices, etc. So there is talk at the highest level about introducing those zones, which would be very, very cool. And of course, that will introduce even more freedom when it comes to internet access to the general public, I believe.
So it's like a duty free in Shenzhen, right? Isn't that the
absolutely?
So, Ashley, talking about regulation, the interesting point you made that in China they sort of let tech birth and flourish and then regulate, and you suggest that the West regulates as soon as it's born. I would argue that even if in the West they wish to regulate, the regulators don't know what on earth is going on. And I would argue with anybody who thinks they know how to master artificial intelligence and what you're trying to do inside your company. So even if regulators are starting early, it does still feel that there's a Wild West element to the Western way that the businesses are being grown, and the way that it's regulated by people who struggle, like senators or House representatives in America or elsewhere, to actually know. I mean, the number of times that I speak with people who are in political office who have a telephone with banners, the little red things on top of all the apps, with thousands of unread messages, I feel like they have a long way to go.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, attempt to regulate doesn't mean that this is effective regulation. And of course, it is also impossible to regulate anything before you understand. So where is this going? Am I qualified to give it direction, or who shall be that council ultimately that determines what are the important challenges and what right now is not, you know, kind of our priority? Ultimately, in China, up until very, very recently, it was all about, okay, something new popped up, let it go first. And once it becomes important, then we come in and we look into how to sort that house clean. And I've also watched those, Senate hearings that we've all, I think that you are referring to, when they keep asking whether the app has access to Wi-Fi.
It's cute.
And it's
cute.
Very, very difficult to keep a straight face if that's the level of understanding. Mm.
How much do you understand the future of finance? I'm Jim Roos, a top 10 banking influencer and host of the podcast Banking Transformed, where we dive deeply into the rapidly evolving world of banking and financial technology. Join me as I interview industry experts, thought leaders, and innovators as they unravel the latest banking trends, disruptions, and game-changing technologies reshaping the world of finance. Redefine your understanding of the banking ecosystem. Subscribe now to Banking Transformed, available wherever you get your podcast, and now available on YouTube.
So there, I wanted to ask about, let's say the things that are hard to replicate outside of China, because it was my understanding, this is how I view these things, that the reason for this sort of super app and the success of these big companies in China is related in part to the fact that your almost code of admission, your username, is more the way you pay, as opposed to in Europe or in the States, where everything is by email. So I open up an email address, I can attach more or less my real name, and that gets me access. Whereas in China, it seemed to me the Tencents and Alibabas of the world, you start with putting in your money link, and that is your identifier, or at least that's what I understood is part of the Chinese difference.
So Chinese social media and, let's say, digital landscape is different in a few ways. First of all, in the West, back in the day, when people were still looking at Amazon and thinking that Amazon is only selling books online, China was already purchasing everything online because of SARS. SARS came, people were scared, nobody was, you know, going out or traveling, and that was a necessity. So people were forced to move to Alibaba, to a platform called Taobao, to purchase daily necessities. And that was a big, big push towards the digital lifestyle. Back then, Alibaba started acting as a bank. Why as a bank? Without a license, by the way. Why as a bank? Because when you purchase the product, they would not release your funds to the seller before you said that you received the product and you're satisfied with it. So they acted ultimately as the intermediary, saying that I'm going to hold your funds and I will only release them later on when you are happy. So today, Chinese consumers have enormous trust placed with the platforms, with the bloggers, with the ecosystem. And in the West, we didn't really have that. Now, up until much later, first of all, the desire to even go and purchase online. Why? I want to touch, I want to feel, I want to, you know, I want the whole process. So they didn't have this push towards the digital consumption. Number two, they didn't really trust because there was so much. First of all, there was this internet bubble, right? The bubble where people saw large platforms becoming kind of big and famous and then dying overnight. So there was not much trust placed into those players. And of course, why would I send my money somewhere? I actually have credit card. Why can't I pay directly to this brand? Why shall I pay to some platform with my credit card then to potentially receive this product? It was just really, really confusing and not clear. And again, trust was missing. And going forward, China was able to turn that into a whole digital identity kind of verification pool. Because later on, when you had, let's say, WeChat, right? WeChat at first was a, as I said, not a very exciting copy of, let's say, WhatsApp, right? It was just a messenger. But they, at one point, introduced peer-to-peer payments, and they actually promoted those peer-to-peer payments during the Chinese New Year, where people sent each other red packets full of money. So if somebody, if Minta today sends me $100 as a gift, I actually want to withdraw this money. I want to convert it in real cash. And then I also, by receiving this money, opened my wallet and I can send it to my friends, kids, or to whoever. So that became a really, really big thing, this peer-to-peer transfers. Again, they acted as a bank, but they were not a bank. And later on, they opened payments, connected. So they started with a habit first, and habit always came from the need. Rather than inventing the need and pushing your customer there, they said, okay, SaaS, right now that's what we need. What's stopping my customers from buying? Oh, the fear that they're not going to get the product. Let me hold the money first. And, you know, if anything goes wrong at any point, customers always right, they will always get their money back. Same with WeChat, same with, you know, all other apps. And today we have a situation that because real money, real economy is involved, people are a lot more encouraged to actually verify their real identity. So you have this kind of digital clone of yourself online and you have this unified ID. And of course, we are not at a stage yet where each person, just like in physical world, we only have one copy of Ashley in the physical world. And in the digital world, we don't have just one basically representation of Ashley. It's not one unified ID across all ecosystems, but within an ecosystem, there typically is one unified ID with your real name. Why? Because it's also connected to your outside wallet and you can do all sorts of transactions. You can take a loan. You can contribute to charity. You can pay your government bills. You can apply for the divorce certificate with your husband or wife, all in one place. So that, of course, is very, very unique to China as well. And a lot of people outside of China start introducing that, you know, that whole Black Mirror scenario, saying that, okay, now, there's a social credit system and there is, you know, total control and all your transactions are being traced. And of course, it could go there. Very, very unlikely, but it could go there. But it could go there with any technology. This is just technology. And ultimately, in the current situation, in the current 2023 scenario, it introduces extreme convenience to the customer and it introduces a lot of level of control for the company. And yes, introduces some convenience also for the government. For example, in China, they are able to catch a, criminal, right, through facial recognition, identify where the criminal is within 35 seconds. So, of course, all of this comes together. But ultimately, on the consumer level, on the customer service level, I've just recently returned from the US. And when I compare that to mainland China experience, because I just spent a week in Beijing, it was just back-to-back New York, Beijing. I can tell you, I will take China model at this particular state as a customer anytime because of the convenience, because of the speed, because of the connection, how connected all these touch points are.
Well, it's most interesting, excuse me, the way you describe it, you have this a very pragmatic approach to growing and one that seems to be really focused on the problem of the customer, the desire and habits of the customer. You have the special instance of SARS, the way it impacted China and made e-commerce quicker, just like COVID in the rest of the world made work from home a reality. You also, as you write in the book, you talk about how they sort of skip some of the technological advancements and then end up with this mobile. Now with the credit card, or at least, you know, access to money, and then also you didn't suffer the consequences of the bubble. So that makes for quite a big soup of things, ingredients for this customer centricity and the arrival of super apps, because it just feels like the Chinese are rushing, all these companies are rushing to be the king of the pie with all the apps and do, you know, like the Amazon, the book was called by Isaacson, the everything store. It's like everything is what these super apps are doing. And it doesn't feel like the West is going to get anywhere near to super apps, in part because of lack of trust, in part because of not really centered around the money piece, follow the money. And three, I would also suspect that there's elements of regulation that won't allow for that overly monopolistic titanic size. The government probably would be scared in the West to have any more power in the hands of a super app, Google or Alphabet, or a super Facebook plus Instagram plus WhatsApp and so on.
Yes, I agree. when it comes to the Western unique Western challenges, trust is a big issue, because there's so much talk also, you know, in the media, on the individual level. And again, people view technology as a threat rather than as a friend, because likely they have experienced, identity theft. They have experienced subscribing to a service and then just being spammed nonstop. And when it comes to also, you said follow the money, right? In China, you follow the money. Absolutely, payment is paramount important because you need to have conversion data. Through all these touch points, you as a platform, you as ecosystem, you're collecting data. But what is the most valuable data? Data is not created the same, right? It comes in levels. The most valuable data is the conversion data. When you actually make a purchase, when you actually buy a product, receive a product, and then don't return it back. Not just interaction data. Oh, Ashley spoke with Minta about dog last Sunday. That's also a data point. But if Ashley purchased a pen yesterday at 7 p.m. and it was a purple pen, this is a completely different quality of data. Yes, and apart from all that, the Western platforms are not really customer-centric. As much as they would love to appear, and there's a lot of talk about customer centricity, you only feel it and experience it when you actually go back-to-back, as you said, New York, Beijing. I mean, just do that trip, do that journey, and you will see that it is not the same. Being customer-centric is really putting the customer problem in the center and making it easy for the customer to, speak with your customer service, to negotiate a deal, to complete the purchase, to refund it, return it, rebuy again, to recommend it to a friend, etc. So that customer centricity. And of course, when it comes to regulations, yes, but regulations in the West, because the collective West doesn't actually exist. It's all these different economies that are trying to, negotiate and find some ways to collaborate on major issues, but it's not working. The collective West as a system that regulates or moves forward, it fortunately, unfortunately, does not exist. And there are a few companies today that are very much focusing on building a super app, such as, for instance, WhatsApp. Yeah, so Meta is very much invested in getting WhatsApp up to speed. It will take them a while, but there are markets where Meta products are dominating internet. If we look at Burma, Myanmar, right? A few years ago, the whole internet was Facebook, right? Or Meta as a platform. And of course, they tried to introduce their own messenger. It didn't really work. People didn't want to move to that platform to chat with friends. They tried to introduce their own payments through Apple Pay and all that. Again, it's a very limited success. They have some success with their shops and, marketplaces, but you just get too much spam and, you don't really qualify your sellers. So trust is very, very low. So right now they're looking at WhatsApp as an opportunity to create a curated private pool, private traffic, a community where brands and businesses can actually build a meaningful direct-to-consumer conversation, CRM, et cetera, et cetera. The app is not ready yet, but you've also, if anybody's using WhatsApp here, you've also seen that there are a lot more features on the groups, on the privacy. You can send messages to yourself now. You can encrypt the chat, et cetera. So they're moving in that direction, and there's a lot of companies already today that are on their website, on their whatever apps, they're actually connecting the customer service to WhatsApp backend and start operating direct to consumer a lot closer. So it's not unimaginable that in a couple of years from now, they will be able to arrive at one point or the other at some version of the super app.
Yeah, maybe a mighty app, not the super app. Yeah. Working on it. And the other thing that it brings up is that, as you write in the book, and I was like, oh, wow, WeChat. When I first discovered WeChat, I think it was probably because I was going to China and I got on. And I was like, oh, my gosh, it's so much better than WhatsApp. And then you told me and I felt, oh, no, WeChat outside of China has nothing to do with the WeChat inside of China. And I was like, oh, well, it was so good. And that's why I sort of deflated on WeChat. It doesn't have as many bells and whistles as maybe it has inside with the, and you see so many of these little things that were started in WeChat, as far as I can tell. For example, having images or icons or emojis fly up the the screen. That was something that I remember with WeChat happening by itself. If you wrote Happy Christmas to somebody, all of a sudden it knew that and had little Christmas trees running up the screen. Not so many innovations now. But let's park that and move on, because some of the things that are interesting to me are with regard to management and leadership. And so you have these huge companies now. I mean, genuinely, you know, top of the world type of companies, and building culture and management styles. And you talk about obviously some good, some bad in China and what other companies can bring. But I have to believe that at this scale, they are suffering from things like a burnout. They are suffering things like bureaucracy. And how do you keep that? What do you call it? You have some form of leadership, which is very cowboy-like. The maverick, that's it. The maverick leadership style. In China, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, what is the narrative around purpose? Is purpose a thing like it might be at a Patagonia? Or are we generally sort of, I would say, in a smaller level, purpose is making money, purpose is making customers happy, and that's the level of purpose?
Very good question. So again, anything that I say will be a gross generalization. China is a big country. There's a lot of different companies that have their own philosophies, and there's a lot of people that connect with the company because they just need money or because they really want to contribute to something larger themselves, just like in any other country of the world. In general, if I could talk about Chinese kind of philosophy, very often Chinese in general, when they view any situation, they are a lot more holistic, a lot more harmonious. They look at a problem or at a situation as the whole system. So in other words, they are looking at the forest, not a particular tree. But in the West, we typically single out the problem. We call it our mission. And we try to solve that specific problem through the company, and we call it our, you know, we name it our calling or whatnot. So looking at, you know, champion companies such as Alibaba, for instance, right? Up until recently, right now they're going through their own internal mess with all the restructuring, you know, top people losing some of their posts and, of course, being divided into six different entities plus Alibaba Group. That's a whole different story. But Alibaba for years was operating out of 100-year strategy. So they had a big, big vision. And the same thing happens with, for example, Huawei. Huawei says it doesn't matter whether it's going to take me 3 years longer or 5 years shorter, but my big vision is to become the biggest infrastructure provider for the next age of humanity. So if this is your goal, if you look at it so big, it doesn't matter whether somebody puts sanctions on your mobile phones, right? Because you just have a very, very big long-term plan and vision. So on the one hand, Chinese companies very often have that big holistic, let's say, view. But at the same time, Chinese companies are also operating in a very competitive, very fast-paced world where they need to deliver results yesterday. Everything had to happen yesterday. And they can only work like this through what we call DIDA, right? It is digitally enhanced direct autonomy. In other words, you need to allow your middle managers and lower managers to autonomously solve the problems. So when I go and ask a customer service person, when I'm purchasing, let's say, a phone case for my phone, I go and ask her, do you have that same phone case, but in orange? She will reply me within 30 seconds. Typically, 90% of companies reply within 30 seconds. And then she will say, no, we don't have orange, but we have this kind. And you can order orange, but it's going to cost five times more expensive. We're going to do the, let's say, tailored color for you. So she is able to solve my problem. If I am an unhappy customer, they have just like with Virgin Atlantic or previously Zappos, right? They have certain autonomy to also make sure that I am happy and ultimately have a good experience. So Chinese companies work through that autonomy. That puts enormous pressure on not only managers, but also teams. And this is where we have, 996, right? 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. Sometimes they work 10-10-7. Sometimes, it's even tougher. But ultimately, on the one hand, it's a crazy pace of the market and digitalization. On the other hand, is that the pressure and responsibility and accountability is on you directly. You cannot always push it up to your boss and think that, okay, the big guys in the big room, the boardroom will handle your problem. And on the other hand, of course, there is a certain toxicity, not only in China, but in the whole, let's say, Asian setup, when you don't leave your office before your boss leaves the office. That happens across, Japan, South Korea, and many other places here in Asia. And I'm sure, in many other places around the world. So all of that comes together to create a very stressful environment. Apart from all that, as I said, China is a very competitive market. So unless you work for somebody like Alibaba and Huawei, and even those companies went through big, let's say, layoffs, right? The tech layoffs that were happening in the past year and a half, your job is on the line. And you need to deliver. Like, for example, Xiaomi, one famous tech company, in reality, they are an IoT platform. They have a platform for IoT devices for your home and for other places. And they are looking for all these inventors that come to them with hardware products. And they say, okay, I'm going to take this product and I'm going to put a Xiaomi logo on it. I'm going to manufacture it in my facilities potentially, and I'm going to plug it into my ecosystem. But so this is the company where they do not have a strategy that goes on for years and years. One of my friends working for this company jokes and says, our only strategy is double every year. No matter what you do, if your department can double every year, you're doing a good job. So invent new products, cut half of your staff, do whatever you want, double every year. So again, that creates a certain also way of operating that is very, very different from a structured top-down or bottom-up, numbers-driven, projections-driven strategy. Because many Chinese companies have seen again and again that doesn't matter how much you project and how much you plan, the reality hits, and it very often hits differently. So there's a lot of things we can learn because Chinese management and leadership models have proven to be innovative, have proven to produce outstanding products, outstanding customer service, outstanding returns. And of course, they also have produced very tough, working culture that is not balanced and, definitely not sustainable long term. So there are things that we can learn from China's leadership models. And there's a lot of things that Chinese companies, for the benefit of their longevity as a business, also need to learn from, let's say, collective West.
Well, that was why I was excited to have my book Future Proof translated into Chinese try to bring some of the Western thoughts into that. So just to recap, what I heard there was that the Chinese have a very holistic approach over, a much broader view. And it reminds me of the Japanese, the same. They have that same sort of full context view. They don't look at the individual in the painting. They say there's a painting on a wall in a house. As a, what do you see in that painting? And then very long-term vision, which also the government, of course, takes. And then the funny thing you add is it's also very fast. So fast, long-term thinking is sort of what I felt captured it all. And then you mentioned this DIDA, the digitally enhanced directed autonomy, which is very interesting. So purpose in this regard would, in my opinion, seem to be a very low level version of purpose, as opposed to, making the world a better place or trying to be.
I would say, this is the side of the question that I kind of omitted. I lost in the train of thought, but I believe it is dual. First of all, the purpose is always harmony. Harmony. It needs to be harmonious development for the majority. So harmony is always not about an individual. It's about the majority. So This is very big, and for majority of people, companies, government offices, harmony is the ultimate outcome. And then the second layer, the layer under that, is you need to add value and make money. As long as you add value to your customer and make money in the process, you're all good. And the big direction is harmony.
Fascinating. So there are other things which in the West we get all excited about. Transparency is one of them. We talk about trust, authenticity. And you mentioned how everybody has an account that actually is real. In other words, it's me behind the account. You can't hide behind anonymous things. And then things like mental health, diversity, inclusion. Which of these are landing big in China, and which are, let's say, there's no real emphasis on it?
All the topics that you've mentioned, all the topics that are occupying minds of people in Namibia, Germany, the UK, Brazil, or the US are occupying the minds of people in China. So we are ultimately all very much the same. The degree differs. For example, right now, a very big topic in China is green agenda, and people really genuinely care about it. They are willing to pay for greener alternatives. They are asking themselves, how can they be part of the solution, or how are they being part of the problem? They are keeping companies more and more accountable, etc. So this is, again, a global thing.
Just want to say that's something that the West probably has a different view of. They tend to group China with pollution, fast growing, and so on. I mean, I think that's how we view it outside. So that's a really interesting insight.
And per capita pollution in China, as of, let's say, household garbage in China, is lower than that in the US, much lower.
Well,
so
the US
when we talk
is so
about
bad
China,
on trash.
Is the biggest polluter. Per what? Like,
absolutely.
Per capita, it's not. But per what? If China is the factory of the world and manufacturing is inherently polluting, then okay. But if we are manufacturing for the world, so there's a lot. Of course, data, any number can be played the way you want to play it. And I would say we shall always tell human stories. And humans, like Chinese people, just like any other person in the world, want to, live happily, want to progress in their career, contribute beyond themselves, make money, provide better life for their children, enjoy a few holidays a year, and, eat nicely. And it's very human desires. And when it comes to insecurities, when it comes to their dreams and hopes for the future, they are all the same. And green agenda, we all understand that we live on this planet. We are not just Chinese or American or British or Uruguayan. We are humans first, and we have this one planet. And, more and more people, young people in particular, take that stance that we are humans first. Right. And that is why calling somebody, you are contributing most to the pollution, playing the numbers, it is a very dangerous thing to do, because we take it away, we make it less human, and make it very, very, very negative. And it's difficult to build bridges when we make it so negative. Again, because data can be so manipulated. Easily manipulated. So the second thing that Chinese obviously care for, just like people around the world do, is mental health. There's a huge mental health crisis globally, and China is not an exception. China, in fact, has probably gone through an even more dramatic shakeup during this whole pandemic. Yeah, the pandemic started in China. Then it was sort of brought under control in the first 1 year, 1.5 years. It was actually very properly managed, and people lived almost normal life. But then the last year of the pandemic, with all the lockdowns and very, I would say, severe implementation on the ground. It wasn't the central government, but it was on the ground implementation where, of course, a lot of incidents happened that should not have happened, right? They shook up the whole nation. People are tired. People do not see the future as optimistic as before. China was a very optimistic market. Imagine this, for 30 years, every single year was much better than the year before. Not just a little better, but much better. And suddenly we go through this pandemic. Obviously, it is psychologically difficult, economically difficult, and people feel they are totally out of control, that nothing that they do matters. Tomorrow they can be locked up again and not able to leave their house, and they have to order food at 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the morning on the app in order to eat. And this is 2022 we're talking about. So of course it was extremely difficult. And a lot of young people also lost much when it comes to social skills, right? If you are, let's say, in school, imagine you're in high school and university. For 3 years, you're barely interacting with your classmates and you're sitting in front of a Zoom call or, you know, a Chinese version of that. It's just not nice, right? So a lot of professionals, they decided to reinvent themselves and moved to smaller towns, opened coffee shops, decided to take a year off and travel the country. Some people, you know, changed their attitudes to life. They do not want to be persuaded by their parents or grandparents to get married anymore. They want to be happy singles. They move in with their girlfriends or boyfriends together in a big house and just live as friends, etc. So a lot of things are shifting. Of course, a lot of elderly. China is an aging society. It ages very, very fast. And a lot of these older people also do not want to be the caregivers to their grandchildren, right? They want to live their own life. And this is a big shift from what we had, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. They say, you know what? I'm still young. I'm strong. I don't need to take care of my grandkids. I want to be, again, surrounded by my friends, living in a little house, fishing every day, traveling the world, etc. So psychological crisis comes with shifts in behavior, in shifts shifts in self-identity. And of course, I would say 80% of people that I know that live, either foreigners that live in mainland China or friends that live in first, second tier cities, 80% of them have a coach or a psychologist with whom they call talk at least once every 2 weeks. So there's also a huge industry on the rise. And unfortunately, because the industry is so young, the quality varies. Yeah, sometimes it is great. Sometimes it is just very, very bad. So that is another thing. There were a couple of other points that you've mentioned apart from mental health. What was
Things like transparency. How about that one?
Yeah. When it comes to transparency, are you talking about data transparency or talking about...
Well, there in general, there's just calls for transparency. I want to know how your AI works. Right. I want to know what you're trying to do. What are your motivations?
Right. So in general, in China, we need to understand that there is a social contract with the government. And the social contract is, as long as the government delivers growth and everybody lives better year after year, we are giving the mandate of heaven. So mandate of heaven is actually a very imperial Chinese concept, saying that if the emperor or the dynasty rules us well and we continue to thrive, we as people are going to continue supporting this regime, this dynasty, this emperor. So this mandate of heaven is exactly the same thing. There's a social contract. And Chinese people understand that the access to certain information or certain platforms or certain concepts is restricted. They know it. It's not a surprise to them. If they really want to access a different information through VPNs, a portion of population can do that. But at the same time, in general, there is rather a strong trust in government, that government has the best intentions for the majority of people in mind. And that is why when it comes to, let's say, regulating platforms, right? I want to know how exactly your AI works, or et cetera. People generally place, in my opinion, subjective, of course, more trust in how government regulates those platforms compared to the West. Because in the West, most of the people just say, oh, you know, these guys are not qualified to regulate these tech companies, and these tech companies do whatever they want with my data, and I feel really insecure and unprotected. And if I want to be protected, I need to be the one doing that. So So I need to start my own kind of mini research. I need to, you know, opt out of everything. I need to take charge. In China, very often, because of this social construct and because of the environment, people still, I believe, trust the government a lot more when it comes to actually having their best interests at heart and regulating the platforms. And if something goes wrong, you know, they can, you know, exit platforms, quit, complain, create a PR crisis for this company on Weibo or any other platform. So that, you know, these are some of my thoughts when it comes to transparency. But of course, transparency can take many different forms.
And total transparency basically never exists anywhere. Ashley, there's so many other questions I would have loved to plow into. You're a font of much information, insights, great energy. And what I do is I would recommend anybody who's listening and still listening to go and check out a lot of books that you have, what you write about, follow you on LinkedIn if possible. You have your great newsletter. What are the best ways? What links would you like people to go to check you out, Ashley?
Just check me out on LinkedIn at Ashley Dudarinok. And yes, I also have ashleydudarinok.com where you can see more about myself, or there are two companies. One is called chozan.co and the other one is elleries.com.hk. And any of these means would lead you to connect with my team. And of course, if interested in any insights from Digital China, just follow me on any social media channels. My outcome is to give you a slightly different business news from China that are human stories, that are more real, I would say, and less charged, and always focused on business, because ultimately, business is great because we come together, add value, and make money. And everybody in the world, independently on whether they're based, ultimately want to add value to something bigger than themselves and in the process make money to sustain themselves further.
Ashley, спасибо большое. Shay, should I say? thank you very much.
Thank you, Minta. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minta Dialogue podcast. If you like the show and would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MinterDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 and more blog posts on MinterDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. Feel free, trust is the reason. Still, I won't toe the line. I sit here passively, hopeful you respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building it. I'm a convinced man to live and die suburb. A convinced man in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man in the arms of a woman. Revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. To feel free, trust in my reason, and let me show you why.
I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready for an arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least two traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.